is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. The House holds its first public impeachment hearings. Deval Patrick, the Massachusetts governor, the former governor, enters the 2020 presidential Democratic race. And the Supreme Court weighs in on the fate of around 700,000 immigrants to this country. We're talking about the nation's top headlines on the domestic news roundup. Joining me here in the studio is Kimberly Adams. She's a correspondent with Marketplace and a fill-in alumnus here on 1A. Hi, Kimberly.
Hey, Todd.
John Stanton is here. He's a freelance journalist and former Washington bureau chief and national reporter at BuzzFeed, also co-founder of the Save Journalism Project. John, great to see you.
Good to be with you.
Elizabeth Landers is here. She's a political correspondent for Vice News here in Washington. Elizabeth, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
The biggest story of the week, of course, of the month, is impeachment. The inquiry entered a new phase this week, you guys. We heard public testimony from key witnesses. I want to remind everyone that this story is moving rapidly, so be sure to check with your local NPR news station for the very latest in the impeachment inquiries. But this week, lawmakers in the House, in the Intelligence Committee, and people around the country heard testimony from two key people, George Kent and Bill Taylor, both government officials, both involved in Ukraine. Elizabeth, George Kent and Bill Taylor, who are they?
So they're both top State Department officials, and they testified on Wednesday. Bill Taylor was the former ambassador, I believe, in the Ukraine, and he testified, basically, he was the first person to lay out this quid pro quo. So we got his testimony about a month ago, an opening statement, a document that he released, and that was sort of the trigger that kind of started all of this in the public eye after we got that whistleblower complaint. So both he and George Kent testified on Wednesday for hours before the committee, and they laid out what they saw as the policy of the United States in the Ukraine.
Now, we're going to talk a lot more about the quid pro quo, about calls that people said they heard, might have overheard, who's coming up in testimony next week and even today. But Bill Taylor told lawmakers something that he witnessed, and he put this whole thing into some pretty stark terms. Listen.
I encountered an irregular, informal channel of U.S. policymaking with respect to Ukraine, unaccountable to Congress, a channel that included then Special Envoy Kurt Volker, U.S. Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland, Secretary of Energy Rick Perry, White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, and, as I subsequently learned, Mr. Giuliani. I was clearly in the regular channel, but I was also in the irregular one to the extent that Ambassadors Volker and Sondland included me in certain conversations. Although this irregular channel was well connected in Washington, it operated mostly outside of official State Department channels.
John Stanton, Bill Taylor there describes a diplomatic channel and a shadow diplomatic channel kind of going on parallel in Ukraine. What does that tell us? Why is that important? Because that might seem bad, but I'm not sure if it's impeachable.
I think the idea that of having a shadow channel, that's probably not an impeachable offense. But given the fact that the President of the United States is a real estate developer and has clearly done some shady business practices in the past, it points to basically like a pattern of behavior. And it also lays out sort of how this quid pro quo was going to be laid out. They weren't going to go through the official channels, right? They're not stupid like that. They were going to use this sort of backdoor into doing this, and these people were the ones that were directly involved in it.
Giuliani, Sondland, the others leaning on the government of Ukraine to bring forward investigations of the Bidens, right, and to make it clear to the American public somehow that it was Ukraine and not Russia responsible
right.
for election interference, which was the conclusion of our Intelligence Committee. Kimberly, Bill Taylor also says, now this might be getting toward the impeachment question, he says that he was told of a call between the President of the United States and another key witness the day after that now famous call, the one we've seen the memo about where the President speaks to Volodymyr Zelensky of the Ukraine, where Taylor says the President asked Gordon Sondland, lots of characters in this story.
Yes.
What was happening with investigations? On that call, people were sitting next to Sondland. They heard the President's voice on the phone saying, hey, what's going on with those investigations that we talked about? And now we learned of a new character David Holmes, who says he was at the table, that he was not a hearsay witness, that he heard that coming through the phone. Now, a lot of names I just threw out, but we're talking about people.
And also Soraya Jayanti, who was also somebody who overheard that call.
Another name we're going to hear, another person sitting around the table with Gordon Sondland, who heard the president's voice over the phone saying, "What's up with my investigations?" Why is that important?
Well, first of all, we should acknowledge this is a vast cast of characters, and it is hard to keep track of all these different people. But one of the reasons that this is important is because this is one of the first times we are hearing about potentially the president of the United States directly being involved in kind of pushing this agenda. Up until now, it's been mainly Giuliani, maybe Gordon Sondland, maybe some of these other people. But if this is true, then this would indicate that the president of the United States was sort of really on the ground involved. Now, what the Republicans pointed out in Wednesday's hearing is that we are talking about sort of secondhand, thirdhand, and in some levels fourthhand information. Bill Taylor talking about a call overheard by some of his aides of Gordon Sondland talking to President Trump. And it's one of these avenues that's sort of giving Republicans a bit of an opening to poke holes in this argument.
Now, I want to play you a piece of this week's testimony because it introduces another important character, another name. So try to keep your head straight, which is part of that. We're going to also talk about the messaging of this impeachment and why all of these names, this huge cast of characters, might be making it a little bit difficult for people to follow this story and why Democrats are trying to keep it simple, stupid. But here's another character before we get to that. Let's hear what diplomat George Kent had to say. He was talking about a colleague here in front of lawmakers. Listen.
She was dedicated, as is every U.S. government official in Ukraine, to help Ukrainians overcome the legacy of corruption, which they actually have made a number of important steps since 2014.
Now, some in Ukraine probably disliked her efforts to help Ukraine root out corruption. Is that correct?
As I mentioned in my testimony, you can't promote principled anti-corruption action without pissing off corrupt people.
He says that someone in the U.S. diplomatic corps pissed off a lot of people in Ukraine and maybe even in the U.S. government, too. He's talking about Marie Yovanovitch. Who is she?
So that's who is testifying today on Friday, right now before the Intelligence Committee. And she is the former acting ambassador there as well. And she has served under various presidents, which I think is something that the Democrats are trying to play up today. She was also a Bush appointee. So she is a career service diplomat. In her opening statement, she talked about how she has served in Somalia and other dangerous places around the world. And she puts America policies first, and she promotes America and American values abroad. So she is testifying today, and she is a key part of all of this because Rudy Giuliani was trying to get her out of her position, and she's also the person who is mentioned in that readout of that July 25th call. She is the person who the president mentions to President Zelensky on the phone, saying that she was a not a good person and that she'd had some issues. So he was personally attacking her on the phone with the president of another country. So I think a lot of her testimony today is going to be defending herself and her work.
John, why does Marie Yovanovitch's ouster, why is it important in the impeachment inquiry? Again, the president can fire ambassadors if he wants to. That's not impeachable. Why is it important?
I think it's important kind of for two reasons. The first, I think, and the most important, obviously, is that she was clearly not going to be part of the shadow diplomacy that was going on. And I think it was very clear to Rudy Giuliani and to others around the president and apparently potentially to the president himself that she was not going to be amenable to pushing for these investigations into Joe Biden and his son. And they needed her out. They needed somebody that was going to be more okay, basically, with doing this. The other thing, though, is that like she also clearly had done something to upset Rudy Giuliani and some of his business partners, and which again sort of points to this sort of sketchy business dealings and just activity by the president and those surrounding him. They clearly did not want her there. It seems well before the talk of having these investigations had started. They were trying to push her out then, and so I think it all sort of comes back to like just sort of swirling group of kind of weird, sketchy people that the president surrounded himself with on Ukraine.
And it seems to go to motive, right?
Right.
Masha Yovanovitch being asked, it seems to go to motive of the people around her. We got this message from Phil in Indianapolis who said, President Trump promised to provide a transcript of a second call with Ukraine on Tuesday. I heard it was supposed to be postponed to Thursday, but then I've heard nothing more about it. Called a second call, but it was actually a call, Kimberly, that took place before the now famous call from July. What do we know?
Well, this actually was entered into the formal testimony this morning at Maria Yovanovitch's hearing. The Republicans read out this reconstructed transcript of the call. It was basically a congratulatory call between President Trump and Zelensky, basically saying, congratulations, you won your election, Mr. Zelensky. And they were talking about arranging.
What does the White House think it proves?
The White House is arguing that this proves that they had a good relationship and that there was no pressure involved and that they talked at that point about meeting and that the meeting was coming. And
but this was before all the allegedly bad stuff, way before it.
It is way before, but this is the argument nevertheless.
Okay.
Ideally laying out that they had a positive relationship that wasn't involving pressure.
I walked down this street a couple of months ago and I didn't rob any houses, I guess is the message there. Still to come, we'll talk more about impeachment and messaging about the Supreme Court and about DACA. I'm here with John Stanton, freelance journalist, formerly of BuzzFeed, the Save Journalism Project, Kimberly Adams from Marketplace, Elizabeth Landers with Vice News. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's great to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
News breaks and big stories change every day. That's why we're giving you NPR's 10-Minute Morning News Podcast on Saturdays, too. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up first, start your day with us weekdays at 6 Eastern and Saturdays at 8, a bit later to suit your weekend from NPR News.
Welcome back to 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're talking about the week's top news stories, the national stories, with John Stanton, freelance journalist, formerly with BuzzFeed, currently the co-founder of the Save Journalism Project. Kimberly Adams is here. She's with Marketplace. And so is Elizabeth Landers. She's with Vice News. Gang, the impeachment inquiry continues its public phase, but we were talking a little bit in the last segment about the messaging and how a lot of this, there are a lot of characters in this story. It can be very confusing, and how one side of this story is trying to keep it very simple if they can. We already talked about all the names that we've been hearing in this story. So many characters: Taylor, Kent, Sondland, Yovanovitch, Holmes, Mulvaney, Giuliani, of course, Trump. I could go on. Democrats are trying to keep this simple. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, said something yesterday that caught a lot of people's attention. Listen.
The bribe is to grant or withhold military assistance in return for a public statement of a fake investigation into the elections. But I am saying that what is the president has admitted to and says it's perfect, I said it's perfectly wrong. It's bribery.
The Speaker of the House, Kimberly Adams, says it's bribery. What does that mean?
Rolls off the tongue a little bit easier than quid pro quo, I think.
It's not Latin, that's for sure.
It's not Latin. We also heard this from Adam Schiff, and this seems to be a messaging thing that the Democrats are latching onto. So much of the time, this fuzzy language around impeachment in the Constitution, lots of people have been focusing on the high crimes and misdemeanors part, which is, you know, what does that mean and how does Congress determine it? But bribery, which is also listed as a reason, is a bit more straightforward. Now, whether or not the crimes and well, whether or not these things that are being alleged to have done by the president and his cronies are potentially bribery, that's what Congress is kind of trying to argue at this very moment. But yeah, you're right. Democrats have a messaging problem. Republicans have basically been saying, you know, this, it doesn't matter if the president wanted this at any point, because eventually Ukraine got the military aid without an investigation. So they have a very clear argument as to why this all supposedly doesn't matter. The Democrats need a really clear argument why they think it does.
John, bribery is an enumerated crime for a president in the Constitution, as Kimberly says. The bribery here, in Pelosi's mind, in the mind of Democrats, being, I want a personal favor, my personal political fortunes, in exchange for taxpayer money for your government, your country, which is at war with Russia. Does that stick? Is that simple enough? It's enumerated, that's for sure.
Man, I don't know. I think yes, it definitely will stick in the public mind a lot easier than quid pro quo. That's a lot for people to understand, and they don't quite get what that means, I think, in a lot of cases. It means basically the same thing, but I think bribery is a much better talking point for them, especially because these guys, the Republicans, have done a pretty good job of mixing up the timeline enough and having all these names in the mix, and then kind of going, eh, it's not really that bad of a deal, right? Like, okay, so maybe if he did it, who cares, right? Does it really matter? Really?
I also saw about 300 tweets the other day from Republicans and Republican operatives all using the same word, which was boring.
Yeah.
Calling the hearings boring. Elizabeth, why? Republicans, to my lights, don't seem to be talking a whole lot about the president's actions. They seem to be talking a whole lot about the process and why they don't like the way Democrats have executed this impeachment, but they also call it boring. Why?
Well, if you call it boring, then hopefully the public is not going to be paying attention. I mean, the problem, though, is that this is an impeachment probe, and this is very serious right now, of course. And something that I would also just add in terms of the messaging that I have been hearing from Democrats on the Hill is that this, in their eyes, in the eyes of Democratic lawmakers that I've been speaking with and aides, explaining this Ukrainian quote-unquote quid pro quo or bribery that they are alleging is a lot easier to explain than the Russia collusion entire saga that this country went through for the last 2.5 years. And I think that Democrats really learned a lesson from that. They really learned that the Bob Mueller testimony was not the quote-unquote bombshell that they wanted. And I think after that happened, they realized that if they were going to impeach the president, they had to have a much easier case and easier explanation for the American people. And I think that bribery is something that most people understand. I don't think that quid pro quo is something that most people who don't have a law degree understand.
Kimberly.
And also getting back to that boring argument that the Republicans are laying out, one thing that is interesting about this whole set of hearings is that this is information we already have. A lot of the details that are coming out in these hearings were released in the transcripts of the depositions that were done in secret before. And so a lot of this information is what was in the public domain. And so this is pretty much just for TV, but it's long. For radio. but these hearings do last a really long time. I mean, in my very informal poll of my friends and family back in St. Louis and people not involved in politics here in D.C., they're not watching and they're not paying attention, and they expect me to summarize everything for them, but that's another issue.
Fascinating. they're not watching. And when Brett Kavanaugh was testifying in front of the Senate, or James Comey came in front of Congress to justify his actions, a lot of people watched. I mean, more than are watching this. What does that tell us?
I think it tells us, well, the difference, people are exhausted, I think, for one thing. And they're worried about hearing more of the same. I think there's a recognition that many of these congressional hearings can involve a lot of showboating that people don't necessarily want to see. It's also the middle of a workday.
John Stanton, what about the whistleblower? One of the people who helped start this new phase of impeachment and opprobrium over the president's behavior into motion. Republicans are demanding that this person testify. They're demanding that this person be outed. There are whistleblower laws that protect this person's identity. What's the meta story here? What's behind the demands that the whistleblower be made public? And do you think we'll see that?
No, I don't think we will. And I don't think they really want to. I think the Republicans are like, it's a good boogeyman especially for the Republican base to be like, oh, there's this shadowy person that no one knows who they are. Only Adam Schiff knows who he is, even though Adam Schiff doesn't actually, but at least says he doesn't know who this person is. It's a good straw man for them, right? As long as the whistleblower is, in fact, not known to the public, they can continue to bang on this and make this a thing and say that there's some kind of deep state coming out to get Donald Trump and real America and blah, 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 and scare, you know, the bejesus out of a bunch of angry white people. And that's what they want to do right now, I think. And it works for them very well. I mean, in Louisiana, where I live, like, you could talk to people. People are paying attention to this, I've found, more than I thought we're going to. Both sides are doing a good job right now of talking to their supporters. People that think Trump is guilty and should be impeached are really watching this and being like, yeah, he definitely should be impeached. And those that don't are yelling and screaming about, you know, this hidden guy behind the scenes, or does this really matter, or what are they doing? And, you know, so.
Siloed. Yeah. And speaking of the whistleblower, Elizabeth, there was a remarkable moment yesterday. Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, says he does not know the identity of the whistleblower. Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, did something rare for the House. He called Schiff a liar. He was asked if he thought Adam Schiff, his colleague, was lying about knowing the identity of the whistleblower, and he said yes.
Yeah, and this is a perfect example of why people are tired of politics, as Kimberly mentioned. I mean, I think that this is the unraveling of the system when you have members of Congress who are, in leadership, who are calling each other liars. I don't think that that's probably what the American public and people want to hear. But to this point about the whistleblower, I think that this is another part of the process argument that the Republicans are latching onto. The problem for them at this point is that this has become a runaway train when it comes to the whistleblower, because all of the things that the whistleblower laid out in that initial 10-page complaint that came out more than a month ago have, for the most part, been corroborated. There are, you know, a dozen people at this point that have come before the Intelligence Committee behind closed doors and testified. Some of those transcripts have been released, who basically corroborated what the whistleblower said, that there, in their mind, was a quid pro quo for American military assistance for the Ukraine. And so at this point, the conversation that I've been asking Republicans is, does it really matter who the whistleblower is? Because we have so much evidence that backs up what this whistleblower said.
Hey, somebody robbed that house down the street. I saw them coming out of the house. Go check the house. Sure enough, it's been robbed. Does it really matter who told the cops?
Right. No, exactly.
We're going to see where the demands for the whistleblower go. And it's always worth considering the meta story in situations like this. Is it important if the whistleblower testifies? Maybe, maybe not. It might be a lot more important why people want to focus on that part of the story. Let's move on from impeachment to another part of this story, because it's all the same story. I want to talk about Roger Stone. Roger Stone was in court this week. Roger Stone is on trial for lying to Congress. In his testimony about his knowledge of WikiLeaks and leaks of stolen information from the Democratic National Committee. You all remember the spring and the summer of 2016 when WikiLeaks dumped stolen emails on the American public right before the Democratic National Convention in July, and then again later on in the summer. Now, Roger Stone is accused of lying to Congress and obstructing their probe of Russian interference. What did we learn this week from Roger Stone's testimony? Kimberly, you wanted to talk about it a little.
Well, I mean, it's the same argument that Roger Stone and his lawyers have been making, that, you know, not only did he not lie, but why would he lie? Because, you know, President Trump was already in, you know, the nominee or later on already in office by the time that these lies, occurred. And so the argument that Stone's lawyers are making is that it doesn't matter, that Roger Stone had no purpose of doing this. On the other hand, the prosecutors are saying, like, look, here's all this evidence. He was lying about where he was getting his information, and he was lying about who was his connection to WikiLeaks, and he did that for the sole purpose of protecting the president.
Now, we also learned, Elizabeth, something about the Trump campaign that came out in this trial, which was the unabashed enthusiasm that the Trump campaign in the spring and summer of 2016 appeared to have for these stolen documents. Putting the timing aside a little bit, they knew there were stolen documents coming, or appeared to know, and they seemed to be really psyched about it.
Right. And that testimony came from Rick Gates, who has been an ongoing figure in basically all of these kinds of leaks and testimonies that are coming out for years now about how the Trump campaign operated. So he was a top campaign official in 2016. And he testified this week that he was in the car with the president at one point when the president received a phone call.
The future president.
Yes. Right. Candidate Donald Trump in the summer of 2016. He was in the car with him, and that the candidate Trump received a phone call from Roger Stone about WikiLeaks and about information that would be coming out. And the important part about that is that the president has said that he never spoke with Roger Stone about WikiLeaks. So, you know, this sort of speaks to maybe why the president didn't want to speak in person with the special counsel, Robert Mueller, during this entire investigation, because perhaps he would have perjured himself in person if he spoke to him. So it appears that there is a conflict between what the president has said publicly and sworn an oath that he has not ever spoken with Roger Stone about this, and what Rick Gates testified to.
Now let's drill down. Rick Gates testified that the president hung up the phone. He said, future president, Mr. Trump, what did he say? More information was coming. The president was asked about this in written answers by the Mueller investigators.
Right.
What did he say when he was asked that?
I think he said that he had never spoken with Roger Stone about WikiLeaks and information dumps coming.
He also said, I don't recall.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, he also said that, which is not perjury, but he said he didn't remember ever having that kind of contact with Roger Stone. All one story, the Roger Stone story and the impeachment story. It takes a little while to navigate all the streets of this story, but another Trump campaign official named Paul Manafort was dealing directly with Ukrainians at the time and was dealing with Roger Stone as well. Many, many books will be written about this one grand story.
Many have already.
And many have, and many more will, especially when this impeachment show is done. Let's stick with politics, but move on from the justice part of it for just one second. Deval Patrick is the former governor of Massachusetts. He's a Democrat. And there have been whispers for weeks and months around frustrated Democrats that Deval Patrick might dive into this race. Now he says he's getting in, John Stanton. Deval Patrick is in the field. What does he have to offer? Are Democrats clamoring for what Deval Patrick has to bring?
No.
Then why?
I mean, you know, because he's a powerful dude. Powerful dudes want to run for president, I guess. It's like the thing these days, right? I mean,
he thinks there's an opening, though. What is it?
He does. He thinks that there's an opening to be like Barack Obama 2.0, I guess, is kind of what he thinks he's going to do. I think, you know, Harris is way more suited for that role, probably. He seems like very much like her in terms of their politics. He sees himself as like a moderate kind of progressive kind of guy with a bit of a track record, you know, that he can try to do. And, you know, he's kind of pretty and, you know, I think that's what he's thinking. I mean, honestly, right? I mean,
Kimberly, the Democratic Party's centrists and big donors and Wall Street tycoons have been kvetching publicly that they just don't see a strong candidate in the race. And I guess they were all hoping that Joe Biden, who is strong, would be blowing Elizabeth Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. There's a Freudian slip for you. There's a slip. Would be blowing these two leftists out of the water, and Biden's not blowing them out of the water. Is that the Deval Patrick savior ethos there, that if Biden stumbles, I'm ready to defend the classical triangulated interests of the Democratic Party?
Well, it is this sort of fight over who's going to win the middle, because you have this battle of Warren and Sanders sort of duking it out on the left and not taking any Wall Street money. So the Wall Street money and some of these big, more traditional donors, they like Biden. They like Buttigieg a little bit. But they're Biden isn't as strong as a centrist candidate as a lot of the Democratic establishment expected him to be. And all of this Trump-Ukraine stuff involving his son does not help. But at the same time, This is why we have former New York City Governor Mayor Michael Bloomberg also thinking about it as well. There seems to be space in the middle. Now, with, 17 candidates remaining, it's not like people were oh, yes, we really need more candidates. But these guys really think that they can step in and fill this gap, or maybe just, as John was saying, be there on standby if something goes wrong with Biden.
Elizabeth, it may be more messaging, but I guess the allies of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren point to this and say, well, yes, of course they want another candidate. Of course Wall Street wants somebody else. Right. Of course Wall Street's upset because of the strength of the left in this race.
Totally. They've been so gleeful. Bernie and Elizabeth, excuse me, Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren have both been tweeting about this, speaking about this on the campaign trail. It's a great foil and contrast for them to be able to say, you know, I am the exact opposite, and I am hoping that people in America recognize that.
More with our guests and from you in just a moment. It's 1A. It's the Friday News Roundup. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from The Real Real, the leading reseller of authenticated luxury consignment. Shop luxury clothing, accessories, and fine art at unreal prices from your favorite designers like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Cartier, and hundreds more. And The Real Real authenticates each item to ensure it's guaranteed authentic. Shop in-store, on the app, or at TheRealReal.com and receive 20% off select items with promo code REAL.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please do take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating so that other people can find the show too. Thanks.
What are the things that make us human? Why are we the way we are? I'm Guy Raz. Each week on NPR's TED Radio Hour, we dive into the incredible forces that shape our very existence. Listen now.
It's the Friday News Roundup. During the break, we were talking a little bit more about Deval Patrick and about why moderate centrists, if you like, Democrats are diving into this race, Kimberly Adams, why Michael Bloomberg might be jumping in, why Deval Patrick, a former employee of Bain Capital, is jumping into the race. And you let us know about a little piece of a campaign swag that Elizabeth Warren has been selling.
Right. She has a mug that says Billionaire Tears, which is clearly a knock on the liberal tears mug that you see sold on the right a lot. But yeah, she's really embracing this idea that Wall Street is, quote unquote, freaking out over her candidacy and her, you know, rise in the polls, and the fact that between her and Sanders, there's not a whole lot of love for Wall Street in the Democratic Party.
This was even part of Saturday Night Live satire of Elizabeth Warren, Kate McKinnon's Elizabeth Warren, which is a developing impression. A few weeks ago, there was a similar story, and I don't remember the exact joke, but the whole joke was, oh, billionaires don't like me? Boo-hoo, this ain't for you. That was...
Right.
So the Deval Patrick phenomenon, Elizabeth, at least for Elizabeth Warren, and I guess for Bernie Sanders too, for them, they say, yes, this proves how right we are.
Yeah, and I also think that, look, Bernie Sanders made this contrast in 2016 really prominent on his, you know, during his campaign between himself and Hillary Clinton, that he was, you know, raising from a grassroots base. And that's something that both he and Warren can speak to again this cycle, and that they have a lot of support from normal people who are not the Wall Street types.
Well, everybody loves watching a billionaire get kicked. Like, I mean, nobody except for other billionaires are like, oh, I feel bad for that guy. No, everybody loves it when they get beat up on. So.
And now,
not all that many of them.
And now, if you're an Elizabeth Warren donor, I guess you can drink billionaire tears. I want to talk about Republicans now, since we spent some time on the Democrats. John, when you were a reporter on Capitol Hill for those all many years, you covered a Republican congressman. His name was Mark Sanford. He's from South Carolina. He was also the governor of South Carolina. And up until this week, he was a primary presidential contender against Donald Trump. Mark Sanford is out. He says impeachment has crowded out the ability to break through in this environment. They just can't break through in the field. What was the Mark Sanford phenomenon, and why do you think he's gone?
I think he's gone for a couple of reasons. One is no one cares. And I think that's a reality that, like, anybody trying to challenge Donald Trump is going to face. The party was taking steps in some states to keep basically him and other primary challengers off the ballots in the primary. So he had no support. it. And, you know, he was like kind of like the last dying gasp of this sort of old school, you know, Republicans that were kind of okay with a lot of the stuff that Trump said and did. But, you know, he'd finally gone a little bit too far for them, and they were trying to, you know, salvage what's left, I guess, of the country club Republican image. But that's pretty much dead, right? I mean, like, country club Republicanism is gone.
Kimberly, is that what Mark Sanford was? He was also what's been branded a never Trump voice of the Republican Party. He cast himself as one of the lone, can't be one of the lone voices, but a rare voice in the Republican wilderness who's willing to look at Trumpism and say this is wrong. I'm a real conservative.
And there's a reason that that's rare, because it has not been a very successful look for a lot of Republicans, especially when Trump's Republican base still really likes the president. And so that is not exactly the most winning argument you can have if you're trying to reach most Republicans. Additionally, Trump's fundraising is just wild. And there was no way that anybody on the right was going to be able to compete with that. Even if you look at sort of the fundraising online platforms, the GOP has the one that Trump uses, and they're not letting the other primary candidates use that one. And so Trump has raised more money than I think all the Democrats combined, and so it'd be really hard to break through that.
Elizabeth, there are two other Republicans running against Donald Trump, former Congressman Joe Walsh of Illinois, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld. Are they headed for the same abyss that Mark Sanford has joined, or is there any hope for traction in their campaign?
I would predict yes. I don't see how you break through. I think Kimberly's point about the Trump fundraising machine is that it is a machine. I think Brad Parscale, the Trump campaign manager, has said that they raised $3 million or something like that on Wednesday. They turn these kinds of moments that are, you know, what they perceive to be very anti-Trump when Democrats are impeaching the president, and turn that into a fundraising boon. I don't see how anybody breaks through that at this point. And frankly, speaking of Mark Sanford, he was primaried in his own district last year in 2018 and lost that seat.
Yeah, we should say former Congressman
right.
Mark Sanders, which tells you just about
exactly
what you need to know.
He was primaried by someone who came from the right and won in that primary, Katie Arrington. And then that seat flipped from red to blue when Congressman Joe Cunningham was able to win that. So I think Sanford never had a prayer in this race.
Now, speaking of running for president, speaking of machines, Hillary Clinton, believe it or not, made some news this week. She was in London promoting a book with her daughter, Chelsea, and she spoke to the BBC. Now, Hillary Clinton said that she would not rule out jumping in the race, just like Deval Patrick, running for president. Listen to what she had to say when she was asked by journalist Emma Barnett if she would run again.
So you are ruling it out. Well, look, I, as I say, never, never, never say never. And I will certainly tell you, I'm under enormous pressure from many, many, many people to think about it. But as of this moment, sitting here in this studio talking to you, that is absolutely not in my plans.
Not in her plans, John Stanton, but never rule anything out, says Hillary Clinton.
You know, I think she's just trolling people. Honestly, like, because like that whole, like some of the way she was talking almost sounded a bit like Trump, you know, like people are clamoring for me to come out there. It sounds like, you know, it's like Trump always says, like,
people are saying, right?
Like it felt that way. It read that way when I read it, and then sounds a little bit like that. I really hope that's what she's doing, because Lord, I can't imagine if I was her doing that again. I would.
Elizabeth, is there anything in your reporting that reflects the claim that she's under enormous pressure to run in 2020?
No. And frankly, when I'm out on the campaign trail talking with Democratic voters, I do not hear that. So I'm not sure where she's hearing that from. Potentially it's Democratic donors. It's people, you know, in the billionaire class or folks that are pressuring her to get in because she might seem more formidable than Biden. But no, I don't hear that from people. And in fact, I think Democratic voters are sort of, it's an embarrassment of riches. They feel, a lot of them feel like they have a lot of good candidates, and they're trying to whittle down this current field, which apparently is not being whittled down right now. Instead, we're getting more people in the race. And no, I'm not hearing anybody say that they want Hillary Clinton back in that race.
Now, there's presidential speculation about another person on the other side of the aisle, another person from South Carolina. She's Nikki Haley. She's the former governor. She also has a book out this week. We might talk a little bit about presidential rumblings about Nikki Haley, but Nikki Haley wrote some pretty fiery things in her book. It's catching the attention of the interviewers who talk to her on the air. Here's Nikki Haley talking about what was like, what life was like inside the cabinet of President Donald Trump when she was ambassador to the UN.
There were people within the White House who, I believe, tried to undermine the president. There would be a decision made. They'd stall the issue. They'd undermine. They'd distract. And Rex Tillerson and Chief Kelly pulled me in one day and basically tried to recruit me and said that they were trying to save the country. And I disagreed with them then. I disagree with them now.
Kimberly, there were two reactions to this claim from Nikki Haley. One was there's a cadre of traitorous cabinet officials who are trying to undermine the president. And another that said, well, the point is that they feel they have to, that they feel like they have to, as she said in the words of Rex Tillerson and John Kelly, save the country from the commander in chief.
There's been this narrative coming out of the White House for both of those narratives for the entire Trump presidency, the idea that there's a group of people in there trying to sort of stop him from advancing his own worst impulses, and the other hand, that they're the same group of peoples in the White House not letting the president be president of the United States and the commander in chief. What struck me about Nikki Haley's round of interviews is just how positively she spoke about President Trump. Like, she really dug in. I am pro-Trump. And it reminded me that when she left that post, lots of people asked her if she would ever run against President Trump and ever, you know, primary him. And she was very emphatic, saying she wouldn't. And so while on the one hand, people tend to release these books before they run for president, she's building up her profile, you know, she's being awfully pro-Trump to be thinking about running
Nikki
against
Haley
him.
Nikki Haley says it's not going to happen. I can't plan 5 years out. Donald Trump's the nominee. I'm not doing it. On the other hand, John Stanton, Nikki Haley won't talk about it, but there are plenty of people whispering that maybe President Trump would drop Mike Pence from the ticket for 2020 and that maybe Nikki Haley wants to be on solid footing. You buy it? What is she doing?
I think she's actually like looking to run either if he loses in or one way there in 5 years. I think that's what she's doing. I think this is like her 14th or 15th reimagining of Nikki Haley, who she is as a politician. And I think this one she's hit upon to try to really capture what Trump's got, which is like a huge, very, very aggressive base that supports them no matter what.
Now, I want to make sure that we go inside the Supreme Court before we wrap it up for the day, because justices in the Supreme Court heard arguments this week on whether the Trump administration's policy to shut down the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, is legal, whether they can shut it down. 700 immigrants affected by that. We won't get a decision until the spring, Elizabeth, I guess, but we can maybe divine something from the questions and the interrogations that the justices had in the courts. What did we learn and what's at stake here in this case?
Well, like you said, there are 700,000 people in this country that will be affected by this decision. And we saw Noel Francisco, the Solicitor General, make his case that that Kirstjen Nielsen was saying that this was never a legal policy. And I think that that's what the administration is leaning on right now, that this, when President Obama used this executive order, which is what DACA is, that that was never legal. And that's what the Trump administration has been saying this whole time. Of course, you know, on the other side, you have like a Janet Napolitano, who was the Department of Homeland Security Secretary, I believe, when this decision was made. And she was there on Tuesday, I guess it was, sort of advocating for why this policy should stay in place. I think what this is going to come down to ultimately is how practical is it for the United States to send all of these people back to countries where they might not know the language, they don't know anybody there, and that's the case that
and have never lived in many cases before
exactly.
after they were a year and a half old or something.
Exactly. So, you know, this comes down to a big practical sort of question mark, and this decision, as you said, will not be coming down until the summer, but it seems that this might have a really big implication for the 2020 election.
Well, tell me why. Why an implication for the 2020 election? I mean, justices seemed, had some tough questions as I read and listened to the coverage, but seemed to have some sympathy for the fact that we've all heard so many times, this program exists because these people came to the United States through no action of their own. They were minors. They were children. Their parents brought them here.
I think that when I say it will have implications for 2020, I believe it will have greater implications for President Trump than it would for the Democratic candidate. And I say that because President Trump has made immigration, and build the wall was the chant we heard all of 2016. Immigration and changing the immigration system in this country has what he has tried to make that the biggest policy point of his presidency. I'm not sure he has succeeded because he has been challenged the entire time by the courts.
Kimberly, go ahead.
But at the same time, there was some sympathy and acknowledgement of the difficulty of unwinding this program. But some of the more conservative justices on the court were really poking holes in this argument that those opposing the rescinding of the program were making, that you need to have a good reason in order to unwind it. And the Trump administration never laid out a good reason to undo it. And a lot of these conservative justices were saying, why? It's president's prerogative. He doesn't need a better reason than that.
Now, speaking of immigration policy, I want to make sure we get this in before we have to go. A story that didn't break through a lot of news outlets this week, even though it's critically important. A report released this week by the Southern Poverty Law Center included leaked emails showing that Stephen Miller, the president's top advisor on immigration policy, had promoted theories popular with white nationalist groups and white supremacist groups. 900 emails sent by correspondences with Stephen Miller, where he trafficked in, forward used for justifications for his immigration views, articles, statements, and white papers from groups that most Americans would consider beyond the pale and outside the mainstream of American politics for their white supremacist views. John, you probably dealt with Stephen Miller when he was an aide to Jeff Sessions in the Senate for all those many years. What did you take away from this story?
That it was unsurprising, but that people need to read them and understand that a very virulent racist is making policy in this country. I mean, Chad, I'm sure you dealt with him back in the day as well. You know, I remember when Sonia Sotomayor was up for her confirmation, he would call me up on the phone and make all kinds of crazy claims, whether it was he believed that she was a lesbian or because she was a Latina, that those things were going to bias her against the rule of law if she was able to get in. And I think that these things really prove out just how dangerous he is.
We've been talking with John Stanton, freelance journalist, formerly with BuzzFeed and co-founder of the Save Journalism Project, Kimberly Adams with Marketplace, and Elizabeth Landers with Vice News. Thanks to all of you for joining us. 1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital producers are Gabrielle Healy and Chris Castano. We'll dig into international news in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Protests continue to rage around the world, from Iraq to Hong Kong to Chile. And this week, demonstrators managed to oust one world leader. President Evo Morales of Bolivia is out. So, who is in? We answer that question and a whole lot more on today's Global News Roundup. Here to help out, Courtney Kuby, national security and military reporter with NBC News. Courtney, welcome back.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Emily Tamkin is here. She's a freelance foreign affairs reporter. Her upcoming book is The Influence of Soros. You can guess what it's about. Emily, welcome.
Hi.
Writing about George Soros. Anne Guerin is here, White House correspondent with The Washington Post. Anne, it's always a pleasure to have you.
My pleasure.
I'm glad you're all here. I want to start in our own very capital at the White House this week on the international scene. Impeachment and questions of Ukraine were swirling in the background, but an important international story comes right down to ground zero in the Oval Office this week, because the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, paid a visit to the White House this week, the same day as the start of those impeachment hearings on Capitol Hill. It was only weeks ago that President Trump, Courtney, had a phone call with President Erdogan. And by the end of that phone call, Turkey had a green light to invade northern Syria and go after our allies, the Kurds. So there were a lot of eyes on this meeting. Part of the question is, why now? A lot of people would have looked at this and said, a war just started. There are a lot of unanswered questions about how this war started and if and why the president greenlighted it. Why did they decide to go ahead with this meeting now, and what did we get from it?
Yeah, and so in the ensuing like 5 or so weeks since Turkey moved into northern Syria, I can't even tell you how many times we've heard speculation, oh, the meeting's canceled, or oh, the White House is rescinding the invitation. But sure enough, we saw them standing together for a press conference, which is even more than we had last time the two of them were together. They actually answered several questions. So, you know, there were a couple of big issues to be dealt with here, and there's no indications that any of them were actually resolved. The S-400 is a big one, which is a missile defense system that Turkey bought from Russia. Huge source of contention between the United States and Turkey over that.
Turkey, a NATO ally, bought a missile defense system from Russia.
Right. And it's not just any missile defense system. It's one that has a special radar that can actually spy on U.S. aircraft. Now, we should also say Russia has S-400s in the region as well that can also spy on the F-35s as well, and they can read their computers and whatnot. But for a NATO ally to purchase that, you know, they really should be subject to sanctions, to CATSA sanctions. Another thing we didn't hear about at the White House on Wednesday, that President Trump was actually going to do something about the CATSA sanctions. So I think that we were looking for a lot of answers. We didn't get them. What we did get was a lot of warm language back and forth between the two of them. President Trump, you know, over and over talking about how much he likes Erdogan. We heard things that were baffling to me, candidly, when President Trump said that the ceasefire is holding. I can tell you, I was in Syria days ago and heard the Turkish artillery fire as they were pounding Tal Tamer. So to say that the ceasefire is holding is just factually inaccurate. He also thanked President Erdogan for the work that he's doing in Syria, and he talked about how the Turks have a good relationship with the Kurds. So there were so many things, and I think there's so much attention going on with the impeachment right now that people didn't even recognize that President Trump was standing next to this man who has caused this tremendous upheaval in Syria and in Iraq that has caused a tremendous impact on the U.S. military. And I mean, look at what this is that forced the U.S. military in Syria to do in the last several weeks. They have had to up and leave abandoned bases that were well-established. Manbij, Raqqa, Kobani is virtually empty right now, and move the entire presence to the eastern, northeastern part of Syria, and then move much of the presence into Iraq. It has completely upended the relationship with the Syrian Democratic Forces. I can tell you firsthand, to say that the relationship is strained, they are still co-located at bases, but the Syrian Democratic Forces are, the relationship is virtually fractured. It is almost gone. And this is all because of things that Erdogan did, and Trump held him at the White House this week and praised him.
And Anne Guerin, did we get any eyes, any daylight this week during this visit on some of the opaqueness, some of the mysteries about what exactly went on between these two leaders 5 weeks ago? Not only what they might have said to each other, but what may have been in the president's thinking when he effectively gave the green light to Erdogan to push into Syria and go after our allies?
Well, Todd, I'd say surprisingly little. To your point, everyone was shocked, and Courtney's, everyone was shocked that this meeting happened at all, that the president not only didn't take it off the books, but seemed to enjoy it and prioritize having it, given that it was bound to make President Trump look bad, right? I mean, he's now standing next to the guy who he empowered to invade a neighboring country, and at the expense of a U.S. allied militia is the sort of common understanding of what happened here. And no, we did not get a great deal of clarity on exactly why Trump, what happened in their crucial phone call. What happened with that kind of nutty letter that apparently President Erdogan ignored and may have thrown in the trash?
Erdogan, though, says now, maybe this is a sign of warming, and he says he didn't throw it in the trash. That's what we heard a couple of weeks ago. He said at the White House, that he has returned the letter, Emily Tamkin, instead of tossing it in the trash. Maybe he did throw it in the trash, and maybe he extracted it and returned it to the president upon their meeting. What happened to the piece of paper is unimportant, but what does it say about the relationship, which I'm still trying to figure out?
Right. I mean, you can always go back and take the paper out of the wastebasket. But the thing that I find so interesting about this iteration of the U.S.-Turkey relationship is that if you look at world leaders with whom Trump has sort of warm relations, they fall into one of two camps. There are some... Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel definitely falls under this category. Prime Minister Orban of Hungary sort of did. You could look at Modi in India, right, where the leader has very tightly embraced Trump, but has also has the support of the Republican Party, right? So you say, okay, well, these two leaders have a close personal relationship, but it's also backed by one of the two major political parties, which, oh, by the way, happens to control the Senate. So you say, okay, well, maybe this will be a problem for them if the Democrats take the White House. But for right now, it seems like a sound-ish strategy.
Courtney, the former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who's made news for a couple of different reasons this week, some of them having to do with impeachment, he made news in another way. He told a private audience this week that President Trump's personal or business interests govern his approach to Turkey. That's what John Bolton said. That's an allegation of textbook corruption. What does it mean to have this in the background while Erdogan was here?
I mean, it's no surprise that President Trump looks at every relationship in a much more transactional way than we're used to many politicians and certainly presidents in the past. And it's born out of the fact that, look, he was a businessman for his whole career and not a politician. So that's not surprising to have someone who was so close to him for such a long time and in his inner circle, you know, arguably up until the end, make that kind of allegation is troubling. But I mean, candidly, not really surprising. And look, you know, you look at how President Trump, he talks such a tough game with these people, and then he stands next to them and he praises them. And it's really befuddling to watch. You know, even the letter, you know, whatever happened with the letter, whether it was thrown out, Erdogan said he returned it to Trump, to the president, and which won him huge praise back in Turkey. So why the president allows himself to stand, you know, in the White House with this dictator who caused this massive disruption to the Middle East in weeks and praise him and lets him, for all intents and purposes, embarrass him on his own turf.
I want to disagree with you over one thing that you mentioned. I agree with part of it, but it is true we are used to hearing this about the president, that his personal or political, his financial or business interests drive his approach to a country. But this is coming from his national security advisor. And for the national security advisor to tell an audience that the president's personal interests are driving his approach to a major hotspot in the world. That's shocking. That has to stay shocking, I think, to people.
Yeah. But remember, President Trump has also said that about, you know, he talks about oil in Syria. So I think that kind of approach is not surprising. It is concerning, though.
That's
agree.
True. Anne,
yeah. I mean, I was just saying that that it came from Bolton is surprising, but it also appears to ignore that the whole cross-border incursion, right, or invasion. That doesn't appear to have a direct Trump financial business relationship at all. Certainly there is oil implicated, but Syria is not a gigantic oil producer, and it does not appear that Trump personally is going to benefit in any way from that. That comes from another part of the president's motivation, which is to keep the U.S. out of what he sees as either unwinnable or irrelevant conflicts, which is how he appears to view this one.
One other piece of news from the Erdogan visit, Emily. President Erdogan shocked a lot of people. He pulled out an iPad. He showed a video in the White House to people who were surrounding him. This was described in news reports as some propaganda that he played, and it shocked a lot of people. What was it?
Well, it was basically, to my understanding, it was a PowerPoint about how Turkey is right and the Kurds are wrong. And to the point that I was trying to make earlier, you know, this is not a relationship where it has broader Republican backing, right? Like, there are some relationships where, yes, it's close with Trump and the Republican Party. Here, it's kind of just Trump and Erdogan, right? So you have Lindsey Graham sitting in the White House saying, well, I'm sure I could get a PowerPoint from the Kurdish perspective, too, right? If Erdogan's saying it's warming relations, it is warming relations with President Trump specifically and only. So maybe that's good for right now for this meeting. He gets praised. There's the S-400, et cetera. It's pretty short-sighted for the U.S.-Turkish relationship more generally because Erdogan does not have broader support in the Republican Party, in the House, the Senate.
Gang, let's stick in Syria for just another minute or two because there was an important and tragic piece of news this week as we were pretty focused on Washington and on international relations. One of the founders of the Syrian civil rights defense group called the White Helmets was found dead this week in Turkey. James LeMessurier was a former British Army officer and founder of Mayday Rescue. That's a nonprofit that he was instrumental in creating and training and supporting the White Helmets. Courtney, who are the White Helmets and what does Mr. LeMessurier's death mean to their mission?
So they are a group of volunteers who go into areas in Syria after they've been attacked, after they've been bombed, and they rescue civilians. The Mayday Rescue nonprofit that Mr. LeMessurier founded and funded, they train these volunteers. They bring them into Turkey and teach them emergency medical skills, how, you know, everything to pulling people out of buildings that have been collapsed. The White Helmets really have been this remarkable group who have gained tons of prominence largely on social media, but now they're funded by the UN, by many Western nations. I mean, they are legitimately seen as heroes who go in. You see video of them pulling little kids and babies and people out of these buildings alive and saving them. So, and they have lost. They have been White Helmets who've been killed quite frequently, unfortunately, throughout Syria. So,
do we know how he died?
No, that's the big question. He died in Turkey, where he had been living for 7 or 8 years now, working with his nonprofit. He was found outside of the apartment building where he lived and had an office. And there's some speculation in the Turkish police that he may have fallen. But that's all that we know. And his family has asked for privacy. So what's clear, I mean, I think he's built such a mission that it's not going to fall apart without him. But to lose such a figurehead and someone who had dedicated so many years to saving lives and helping people and really trying to bring attention to the atrocities that civilians were facing in Syria is really devastating.
Well, so often when we talk about violence in Syria, we move to the south only a few miles and talk about violence in Palestine and in Israel. And there was more this week. Another bout of violence in the Gaza Strip. It left dozens of Palestinians dead, hundreds of Israelis and Palestinians wounded. An Israeli airstrike killed an Islamic Jihad leader in Palestine. That set off 2 days of violence and reprisals. And what do we know about the commander of Islamic Jihad that was targeted? What do we know about the timing of this attack?
Well, this is actually a very interesting development. There have been a number of Israeli Gaza conflicts over the last several years, most of them lasting a few days. But those almost entirely involve Hamas, which is the ruling Palestinian body in Gaza. This was Islamic Jihad, which is a smaller group, oftentimes considered more militant. And this guy was apparently a rogue member of that, who was not obeying a larger directive against certain kinds of violent acts. So he was someone the Israelis identified as a particular problem, and went after him. And there has not been the kind of outrage on the part of Hamas and public of course, there's been public condemnation, but it has taken a different tone than these things usually do, as has the international reaction to it.
So does that mean, Emily, that Hamas has sort of sequestered off this attack from their own interests? Yes, they issue public condemnation, but according to Anne, they're not the ones who are taking part in widespread reprisals. I mean, this could be a much broader flare up in this war, and I guess right now it's not.
Well, I mean, I think that Hamas has definitely sat this one out, to use very colloquial language to describe this. I think that, but on the other hand, you know, the ceasefire, as I was walking today, it wasn't clear whether or not the ceasefire was going to hold. There was a family of eight that was killed. You know, those were civilians. And I think if you look at the Democratic candidates and their language on it, there's been some Israel has the right to defend itself, but you also have Senators Sanders and Warren talking about the humanitarian situation in Gaza, which is showing a shift in the U.S. political discourse around this issue. So, you know, it's not as devastating as it could have been. Hamas is not as involved as it could be, certainly. I don't know that this is just going to blow over and go away.
Let's stay in the region. I want to move to Iraq. Americans, I think, across the board were pleased, if you can be pleased about military operation a couple of weeks ago when the president announced that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, was dead just before American commandos got to him. The president has claimed that the terror group ISIS is, quote, 100% defeated. But reports show that ISIS is roaming unchecked in a remote part of Iraq. Now, Courtney, you have just returned. You've got some reporting here. Where does ISIS have a safe haven now? And what about the U.S. line that the caliphate is 100% defeated?
So, I mean, if you look at the caliphate saying, like, is ISIS actually holding land and governing land? So controlling people and provide, for all intents and purposes, acting as a local government, they're not really, not in any large areas anyway, in either Iraq or Syria, but they are certainly defeated. The place that I went to, a place in kind of near Mosul in Iraq, it's called Makmur. And there's an area there that it's essentially a no man's land. The Kurdish Peshmerga patrol up to sort of the ridge of the Makmur Mountains. The Iraqi army patrols to the south of there. But there's this swath of land that's actually designated as an area where that neither of them patrols. And in some areas, it's as deep as 5 miles wide. So literally, you can go to the top of Makmur Mountains and look out into this vast desert and see ISIS fighters walking around. You see them on motorcycles. They actually come out and during the day and bathe. So you see them wandering around naked, which is very odd and not, we didn't show on video, obviously, but they operate there with impunity because neither side is going after them. So they have established this area. And what's more critical than them holding this little area is that they've used it as sort of a line of communication. They're able to move freely from there. And because it moves along this ridge of the mountains, it can move them further south into sort of Saladin, and then ultimately their hope is that they would ultimately make their way back into Baghdad.
Courtney, the history of militant groups that gain control over governments like this, let's even talk about the government of Saddam Hussein, the Sunni government, is that when they are removed from their land and from their infrastructure and from their power, often insurgency follows. They say, okay, we'll go underground, we'll go into foxholes and rabbit holes, we still have guns, we still have bombs, and we still have jihadist motivations. We're not gone. The caliphate may be gone, but the terror isn't. Is that a risk here?
Absolutely. They are underground. I mean, they're already underground, and they're throughout large parts of Syria. They're throughout parts of Iraq, too. I mean, out in Anbar in the west, there's ISIS problems. And there are, while I was in Baghdad, I would sit in on the morning updates of the kinetic activities, what had happened. And there are artillery strikes. There are airstrikes against ISIS every day, numerous ones around the country. So, I think everyone thinks that ISIS, there's still an ISIS presence in Syria, and there absolutely is. And they are trying to rebuild. And this turmoil with Turkey moving in and the U.S. pushing out and the SDF being in, that will serve ISIS well.
If our eyes off the ball.
Absolutely. And the SDF's eyes off the ball. You know, like they're having to turn their attention towards Turkey and towards the Syrian regime and whatnot, and that will turn them away from ISIS, and ISIS already is exploiting that.
You spoke to an Iraqi general who says that he and his troops had a major role to play in the death of al-Baghdadi, that when U.S. forces were closing in, this wasn't just an American commando operation, as wonderful as it was, but that he and his people helped a lot on the ground.
Yeah, I was actually surprised in the days after the Baghdadi operation how many people took credit for helping to find Baghdadi. But this was General Kanani. He's the head of the elite Iraqi counterterror forces, the special op Iraqi military. And they are really responsible for cleaning much of ISIS out, specifically of Mosul, but throughout much of the country. He says that they arrested two people over the summer that gave them very specific information about Baghdadi's location and whereabouts, and that they gave that to the U.S. and that they were able to exploit it and ultimately find him. The U.S. isn't talking a lot about the intelligence that led up to Baghdadi, so we don't really know. Like, Kanani is not the only one who's claimed credit. But the Iraqi government really backs him up. And so I think that this was really intelligence that was gathered from a number of different areas that they were able to put together and ultimately find him. Because remember, he was out in Western Syria, right, not in a place we expected them to find him.
Meanwhile, while we're focused on the Kurdish Peshmerga and on ISIS and the Iraqi army, Courtney, Americans have not really gotten the news that there have been major protests in Iraq. I think I read that 300 people have been killed, 2,000 people have been injured, protests that have been going on for months in that country. They don't seem to be abating. What's going on?
Yeah, a lot of those protesters were killed in early October in the first, like, very violent round. But then they restarted on October 25th. These are anti-government protesters. They're protesting corruption. A lot of them are frustrated with how much influence the Iranian government has. And it focuses on this one place in Baghdad. Much of it is around, called the Turkish Restaurant. It's a large abandoned building. And the protesters have basically taken up. I was really struck when I was in Baghdad by the atmosphere. It's a party. People have their kids, they're singing, they're dancing, there's tuk-tuks driving all throughout it. And then it ebbed and flowed, but there were upwards of, you know, tens of thousands at some point of protesters. And then there are a group of probably 200 or 300 who are along the bridges that would make their way into the international zone. And they're setting fires to tires. They're throwing Molotov cocktails. That's sort of where the more violent pieces, they have been able to breach a couple of times, but everyone is really watching to see, will the Iraqi military and the police who are there react with violence? There have been cases of protesters shot in the head with some rubber bullets. People have been hit by tear gas canisters and killed. There have been deaths. But for the most part, the Iraqi military and the Iraqi police who are there have been able to hold them back without massive violence.
All right. Well, let's bring it back to Washington on the international scene just for a moment, because Anne Guerin, you have some reporting this week, too, that was right in the middle of the news. Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador, has a book out this week, a memoir. She's been all over the airwaves promoting it. In the book, she claims that two of President Trump's senior advisors tried to undermine the president, tried to recruit her to go against the commander-in-chief's orders. Those two people were Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and John F. Kelly, at time the chief of staff. Now, you had a chance to get to Rex Tillerson about this.
Indeed, yeah, and John Kelly as well. I was really startled by this entire part of her book. I mean, everyone has known for a long time that Nikki Haley and Rex Tillerson had beef. They didn't try to hide it very much. But the role of John Kelly was a surprise to me, to have her make the claims that she did in the book. It was apparently a surprise to him, too. His response and that of Tillerson were that, you know, she's absolutely incorrect, that they were not trying to undermine or sideline the president. But what she says in the book, and which I got a copy of ahead of time and interviewed her ahead of time for the Washington Post, what she says is that they were arguing to her and trying to recruit her to essentially a little band of brothers to save the country. That is the phrase she says that Kelly used with her in his office after an Oval Office disagreement. And it was actually over funding for the Palestinians. They were all arguing about this. Trump sent them out of the room and said, you know, come back when you all have made a decision. So Kelly reconvened them in his office. And that's when she says there was an hour-long attempt to get her to see things their way, which was, according to her, that the president didn't know what he was doing and that they, the unelected staff, actually had a better idea of what U.S. policy should be. She says she was outraged by this, so shocked she didn't speak all the way back to New York. What she does not say in the book is that she made a big giant stink about it at the time, and that she went to the president, that she told these guys she was going to out them, that it, whatever. We do not know that part of it. The dispatches do not state.
This is largely the same message that everyone read in that anonymous op-ed in the New York Times. Now, I'm not suggesting that John Kelly or Rex Tillerson or Nikki Haley are anonymous. I have no idea. There's a book coming out. Maybe someday we'll find out. But this is essentially the same message at the heart of that memo, which is that there are people at a high level inside the Trump government that are working to save the country from an unfit commander-in-chief. That part of it, to me, that Nikki Haley said those guys did that, wasn't surprising. It seemed to be surprising to her. What was shocking to a lot of people when they heard those remarks, Anne, was that there were high-level cabinet officials that, if it's true, felt they had to do that.
Right, right. I mean, part of what makes her account of this so interesting is that it echoes the, you know, anonymous things we've heard, both from anonymous him or herself and others, that there was essentially a wink and a nod understanding among some of the president's advisors that, well, we really don't want him to do that, so we'll, you know, come up with a different way. And Kelly actually does not deny that part of it. What he does deny is that he did anything improper in trying to undermine the president. But he his defense is, in a very short statement, but his defense is that he tried to give the president the best advice he possibly could, and to try to follow through with the best decisions he possibly could. And if that counts as somehow undermining the president, then guilty as charged.
Rex Tillerson was known during other arguments at other times when he was being ousted as Secretary of State for being quoted as having some contempt for the president and his abilities to stay focused on international affairs.
Yeah, Haley recounts how he, in her view, Tillerson had contempt for her, too, and was dismissive, arrogant, are some of the words she uses to describe him, and as if he always understood or knew more than everybody else in the room, including the president, is what she writes.
Emily, let's turn to Latin America after spending quite a bit of time in the Middle East. It's been an extraordinary week in that region, major shifts of power at very, very high levels. First in Bolivia, mm-hmm. where the president for more than a decade, Evo Morales, stepped down from his role. He resigned following months of violent protests, questioning the results of his recent election. In his place, Bolivians have a new president, Jeanine Añez, though her leadership is likely temporary. She's called herself, a temporary or a caretaker president. Evo Morales, for his part, calls this a coup. What's going on in Bolivia?
So your reaction to this news, be you a politician or pundit, probably had as much to do with your own personal political opinions as it did what actually happened in Bolivia, right? So if you are sort of left-wing, perhaps you saw this as a coup. If you were more right-wing, maybe you saw it as a democratic restoration. But here's what happened. In 2016, Morales says, I'm lifting people out of poverty. I'm killing the Bolivian president game. I'm going to have a referendum to decide if I can run for another term. The referendum is voted down. Morales then goes to the court, the top court, which is backed with his supporters. And the court says it would be to deny this man his human rights to stop him from running for another term. So he does. It's looking pretty tight as they're counting the votes. And then all of a sudden, there's this strange hiatus of about a day. And when the recount starts, when the vote counting starts up again, it's Morales is the president. So the Organization of American States says, look, we audited this. You should probably have another election.
Irregularities.
Exactly. Protesters, anti-government protesters take to the streets. They are supported by the police and, crucially, the military, which suggests, right, that Morales should step down. So he flees to Mexico, where he's welcomed in by AMLO, the left-wing leader there. And he's saying that this is a coup. Now, the concerning thing, right, is that Añez, who you mentioned, this opposition senator, who's now saying that she's the acting interim president, she came back with a Bible and said the Bible has returned to its rightful place in the Bolivian leadership, because Morales, who is from an indigenous community, right, as a good chunk of the Bolivian population is, had made it a secular government. So the fact that Añez is kind of pushing conservative Christianity is causing some to have concern, right, as is the fact that Morales supporters are facing violence and threats and violent threats. So you have indigenous flags being burned, or reports of indigenous flags being burned. You have threatening WhatsApp messages being sent. A pro-Morales mayor of the city of Vinto was doused in red paint, had her hair chopped off, and made to do like a Cersei Lannister-esque walk. So, you know, it's possible that in 90 days they have, by the time 90 days is up, they have a new election, and it is a democratic, whatever, the democratic norms are reinstated, but it's right now it's a very politically fraught situation that has maybe as much to do with culture wars in Bolivia as it does about righting political wrongs.
There is a long history of meddling when it comes to mm-hmm. Latin America, and that means that whenever a situation like this happens, suspicions of foreign meddling, suspicions of American meddling mm-hmm. come up right away, because there is a history of that kind of meddling. We got this message from one listener who says, corruption bleeds the country country and the masses take to the streets in violent protest asking why this happened when it was clearly obvious who was behind the whole thing. Now, I don't know exactly what the implication is there, but I do know that a lot of people in Bolivia, maybe because of the history of their neighbors in their own country, see what Morales calls a coup and think that there were a lot of other people beyond their own borders who wanted him out.
Well, and by the way, the fact that the Trump administration, in addition to saying, oh, we recognize Añez as the interim president, said, and by the way, this is a sign of what's to come in Venezuela and Nicaragua, right? As though this is going, as though it's not this its own independent situation, and as though Morales, who lifted people up out of poverty, and Maduro in Venezuela, who crashed his country into poverty, as though those two people are the same, right? As though this is all about like the Trump administration's broader Latin American plan, that doesn't help matters.
President Trump said that the move preserves democracy, paves the way for Bolivian people to have their voices heard. Bernie Sanders said he was very concerned about what appears to be a coup in Bolivia. He used that word. He echoes Evo Morales. Two different sides of the political spectrum, maybe less important than what Bolivians are asking themselves. Añez is a temporary president. I suppose she's going to run for re-election and try to legitimize her role. It seems like they're in for tumultuous times.
Absolutely right. And it, exactly. Although she said that elections are forthcoming, a date has not been set. And we sort of need to see if there are election irregularities to the next. And by the way, the OAS, which called for the first election to be redone, is now saying, oh, wait a minute, everybody, please, political calm and stability. So it's going to be a tumultuous time, as you
say. All right, let's move over to Brazil, because President Luiz Lula da Silva, former president, he's known by Lula, by his fans, and by pretty much everyone around the world, was released from prison on Friday after a year and a half behind bars. Thousands of people flooded into the streets to celebrate his release, which could upend politics in Brazil. Lula's political rival is the country's current polarizing president. He's the right winger. You've heard of him. He's Jair Bolsonaro. What message do we take, Courtney, from Lula getting out of prison? Why was he released after 18 months behind bars? And what does it portend for governance in Brazil?
So he was released because the Supreme Court has this new ruling that says that defendants can remain free during their appeals process. So it's very possible that he will go back to jail.
And he's not out of the woods.
So if he loses his appeal, and keep in mind there's actually two big corruption charges that he's facing. The one is the car wash corruption probe, which, you know, everyone's familiar with. It's this years-long money laundering scheme that took down a bunch of politicians and some big executives in Petrobras. But he's also facing another one. So if what's super fascinating about this case is it could go two very divergent ways. I think it's very clear that in the time that Lula is out of prison, he will have an impact on politics because he's going to, you know, he'll pit himself against President Bolsonaro. His supporters are going to will be very vocal, as they already have been. And it, if nothing else, he'll sort of act as a spoiler and, you know, to his opponents. But if, in fact, the Supreme Court annuls his car wash conviction, he would be potentially eligible to run for office, and he could run for president in 2022. But it's also possible that he'll go back to jail. So right now, and I don't think either is going to happen very quickly because it's going to take some time for the appeals process. But right now, it is very plausible that he either is back in jail in a year or two, or he's running for president. And we really don't know which way it's going to go.
Well, we'll see where that goes. I want to make sure we check in on protests in Hong Kong, protesting Chinese treatment of Hong Kong, because those protests have been raging since March. They reached a new level of unrest this week. Here's a clip we have queued up from one protester in Hong Kong, giving voice to some of the violence that's been in the street. People are now having guns pointed at them by police, protesters being shot, and you can watch this video online. The level of these protests and the reaction from authorities in Hong Kong has reached a new level. Listen.
I was standing there, then suddenly two cops ran out and pushed down one people. Then when that protester was on the floor and the cops are still shooting people, and none of the protesters are holding any gears. And I don't think it is necessary to use the gun. It wasn't fair to our people.
That person says cops were shooting people who weren't holding any gear. That was a clip from CNN of a 20-year-old university student describing a protester who was shot on the streets on Monday. A man who confronted pro-democracy protesters that same day was set on fire. And Garen, the protests have grinded on, have raged on since March. Was there a specific incident that has set this particularly horrific week or two into motion here? What's why the escalation now?
Well, there's a little bit of a chicken and an egg issue there. I mean, the protesters would say that the state-backed Hong Kong forces, the Chinese state-backed Hong Kong forces, increased their level of violence and confrontation in containing the protests. The authorities would say that the protests increasingly turned violent and kind of crossed a line that may sound odd here, but they went from being weekend-only protests to protesting during the week. Remember what Hong Kong is. It's a business center. It's a banking center. For the most part, that work is done Monday to Friday. Hong Kong's main value to China is that it is a banking center with lots of international cash. And having protests that shut down the street and the subway in the middle of the week did cross a line for authorities. Then we had the use of live ammunition. The protests themselves have grown in scope. They've locked down huge sections of the city. Schools were closed this week. I cannot from this distance give, I think, proper understanding to what it feels like on the street there. But my colleagues there say that it just feels like you're in a war, that there is a difference in the air. It feels like this is a pivotal moment. Clearly watching it and hearing about it, it feels that way as well.
What's the message of the Chinese government here? I want to draw back from the protests in the street because police, I don't think things happen in China with protests like this spontaneously or by accident. If cops are pulling guns and shooting people, it's because that's the way people above them want it. What's the message?
Yeah, and in fact, there has been, for the first time, there have been a number of messages in the official Chinese media about Hong Kong and about quelling protests there and about doing things the right way. That is a clear signal from the top of the Communist Party, the top authorities in China, that this has gotten out of hand. It is not going the right way, to use the kind of phrases that they use there, which is, you know, clearly gives the local police and authorities what they see as a freer hand. The larger question is, what becomes of Hong Kong and its special status? It is piece by piece, that special status has eroded over the last 10 years, accelerated in the last few. These protests will be a giant pivot point. Either China asserts full control, which probably means full military control, or it doesn't.
And there are local elections in just 2 weeks.
There are, and Carrie Lam is almost certainly out. So eventually, so she's the Chinese-backed local governor, and she's whoever replaces her is almost certain to be a stronger advocate for Beijing than she has been. She has tried in many ways to keep a foot in both camps and to reason with the protesters and to say that she is on the side of the traditional Hong Kong way of doing things, which means that a greater degree of what we would think of as freedom of speech here, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly. She's tried to give some at least lip service to those ideas. Whoever replaces her almost certainly will not.
More influence of the Chinese government, their ability to crack down not only with force and militarily in the streets, but politically as well, with whoever prevails in those elections coming up. I want to end our hour in Venice, one of the jewels of humanity, this beautiful city, seeing its worst flooding it's had in more than 50 years. The city's mayor says that Venice is on its knees and that the historic flooding has already cost them hundreds of millions of euros in damage. Now, Courtney, Venice already famously is sinking, but now the water is rising. We've seen the pictures, the tragic pictures from the Piazza San Marco and these wonderful landmarks underwater. But the message here is a broader one, which is the seas are rising, and unless we do something to stop it, our gems like Venice will be underwater.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is like, it's about the most visual, you know, visualization of climate change that you can ask for. You see these like these dramatic, gorgeous churches and landmarks, you know, that are underwater, and now they're talking about them being structurally unsound and what will they do. 80% of Venice is underwater at high tide right now, and it's the highest in more than half a century, and it's very clear from, you know, scientists that there was this strong storm surge and then winds from the Adriatic that they're saying causes, but it's very clear that climate change is causing the sea levels to rise. As you mentioned, Venice is sinking, and that is just a catastrophic combination here. There's been this years-long project to try to essentially create walls around the city to stop this kind of thing. It's still several years out. It's been plagued by corruption and cost overruns and whatnot, but it doesn't get to the heart of the problem, which is with these two, the rising sea levels and Venice sinking, it's a catastrophic combination.
Jill wrote to us on Facebook, "See Venice while you can. It has one-of-a-kind art, architecture, and history that is well worth seeing, but I just don't think it will be around for much longer, Emily."
I mean, to Jill's point, yes, Venice is an amazing place and we don't know how much longer it will be around. You should also see New York City now, right? Because it's also, like, to Courtney's point, this is not only a perfect symbol of climate change, it is also a perfect symbol of people knew this was happening. Like, they knew that this was coming. They knew the seas were rising. They knew that Venice was sinking, and they didn't put the sea barriers up, right? Because of corruption and because of government infighting, ineptitude, whatever the combination was. It is, so it's not just like, oh, climate change is coming for us all. It's also a warning that if governments don't act, and quickly, there's going to be many, many Venices in the world.
I want to thank you all for being here. And I got this message from Alan as we were talking. Alan said, the League of Extraordinary International Reporters has officially assembled. And it's one of those things that you do that I love to see, says Alan. So League of Extraordinary International Reporters, thanks for being here. Thanks for taking us through the International Hour. But before I let you go, I want to take us back to China just for a moment, because you're familiar with Prime Day, right? We have it here, Amazon's yearly shopping day for its members. Well, Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba has its own version. It's called Singles Day, and it's the biggest annual shopping day on this planet Earth. That commercial bonanza happens every year on November 11th. This year, worldwide record sales, $38 billion, but not good enough for Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba, who says the Singles Day performance, $38 billion, quote, missed expectations. And he blamed the hot weather for it. Is that the nexus of climate change, commerce, and China that we've all been looking for? Jack Ma disappointed in the $38 billion performance. I want to thank you all again for being here. Alan has put his finger on it. This is the Extraordinary League of International Reporters. Courtney Kuby, national security and military reporter with NBC News. Courtney, thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Emily Tamkin, freelance foreign affairs reporter. Her upcoming book is The Influence of Soros. That's George Soros, and you can guess what that one is about. I just said it. That'll be out in store soon. When does it come out?
July 2020.
In the summer. Ann Guerin is White House correspondent with The Washington Post. Ann, always a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
1A senior team is Danielle Knight and Paige Osborne. Our executive producer is Rupert Allman. Our podcast editor is Miranda Fulmore. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillig. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.